This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance.
Hey everyone, I believe this is episode 42 of Alert and Oriented. I'm here with Caroline next to me.
Hi everyone.
And I'm excited to share that Andrew Mohama is back across the table.
Hello everyone, I'm here to, I don't know, keep the reasoning going.
And then next to Andrew is a new face, new voice, yeah. Sam Shi. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Smith Shi. I'm a third-year medical student at Rush. Excited to be here.
And yeah, Sam and I, we're both third years in the same class, and we're, more importantly, friends. We've been good friends. Isn't that crazy? We've been good friends since M1. We've worked on a lot of projects inside and outside of medicine together, but I think this, Sam knows I notoriously don't like group studying. We've only studied together like once in a coffee shop. I remember that. It actually went pretty well. So that gives me good hope for today's episode.
Okay.
And ever since I did IM, I've been like checking in every single time we do a rotation with Andrew. And I'm like, how are you liking? What are you doing? Do you like it? How does it compare? And then I'm excited that he's now doing it too. I'm liking it, I think.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm loving it.
Well, I'm excited for this duo to reason through a case that I had back in June. It was someone I took care of on general medicine wards. Let's kick it off. 38-year-old female, G1, P1, with a history of Graves' disease, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, is coming in for worsening shortness of breath. Her symptoms, so this is June, her symptoms when you meet her for the first time actually started in October of the preceding years, like 6 months ago, when she noticed her legs were swelling. She thought it was just from her recent pregnancy. She had a healthy boy that was delivered in November. After delivery, she weighed 220 pounds. The swelling has continued to progress since then. And then in April of this year, so 2 months before you're getting to meet her, she noted shortness of breath. She saw her PCP. She was coincidentally diagnosed with Graves' disease at this time and started on methimazole and then started on some furosemide Lasix for the swelling. But now it's gotten to the point where she can't walk because of how swollen she's become, and she can't lie flat now because of how out of breath she is. When you meet her, she now weighs 300 pounds.
Okay.
What are you thinking?
I mean, I'm going to start with, I feel like I tend to anchor on a diagnosis right away, and then I'm going to step way back.
Cool.
So all this swelling and all this stuff, I'm like, could this be like a postpartum cardiomyopathy? G1, P1 means, you know, she gave her first pregnancy, and, you know, it's the T-PAL. So she gave a term delivery. So the first number after the P is the T, which is term delivery. So that's my anchoring. And before I like step way back and do clinical reasoning.
You're thinking like heart failure.
Yeah, I mean, we know with Graves, you know, thyroid issues, swelling can be from the, like, pretibial myxedema. You know, you can get swelling with thyroid issues, but to have gained so much weight and have so much swelling unremitting, I can't imagine it's just due to thyroid.
Yeah. I think the thyroid is definitely like, could contribute to the picture, but might be incidental. But I feel like sometimes too, when you feel like lots of stuff like this happening, you want to like find something that like everything leads to one another, but it could just be on its own. You take the cardiac approach, I think that's like a really good one. I'll jump in like women's health, leg swelling, shortness of breath. You did the heart. I'll kind of like try to think about the lungs, like some kind of like PE thrown to the lungs, like lots of small little PE. She's pregnant. There are like hormones that are going up and down. Like she could be hypercoagulable. She has a leg swelling, which like it's not acute. Like I would normally think of like a PE would be or like a DVT that would like throw to the lungs, but I don't know. I kind of am like leaning towards like heme, like something hypercoagulable, and then something with like it being post-pregnancy. Her, but maybe she's breastfeeding. That can like also change like hormones and how coagulable you are. And something like I'm going short of breath, so I'm thinking about the lungs.
Sure. Can you remind us again, Kevin, of her past medical?
Yeah, she's 38, so a young woman. Mm-hmm. Graves, which was recently diagnosed, hypertension, hyperlipidemia.
And she had. Did the hypertension hyperlipidemia exist prior to her pregnancy?
I believe so. So it was chronic hypertension. I don't think she had any issues preeclampsia as far as I remember. And I think she was just on one agent on a statin for her hyperlipidemia and then one antihypertensive.
Are we able to ask some more follow-up questions or?
You'll get more information
soon. Okay.
Before we go, is there anything you think like, do you feel like it's like you put thyroid in the picture of like thyroid just like making the heart more likely to go into heart failure? Or anything like thyroid in and of itself with pregnancy could be leading to like the extreme amount of weight gain and the shortness of breath.
It's possible. I'd be curious to like, and maybe we'll find this out later, what her like levels of T4, T3, TSH, like how bad is this? Is the medication appropriately treating it or not? But still like I don't know if it would cause the severe amount of weight gain, swelling, shortness of breath. So I think stepping back could be an endocrine thing, right?
Endo.
Could be a heme thing, some like hypercoagulable. You know, you want to worry about PE risk, all that kind of stuff. Post-pregnancy, you are hypercoagulable as you are. And then cardiac, which is like, you know, associate, you know, as well with POM, but like cardiac measure.
What about kidneys? What about like kidneys being another cause?
Yeah, kidneys.
Of being like that much water. Like, I don't know, I think you're saying about like, how could you really be getting that much weight gain? It's like heart. And then I'm just thinking of like.
Totally.
Kidneys.
Yeah, some like super fluid overload picture. Yeah. Kidneys can't process it. So if it's severe enough, would it need like a dialysis picture?
Yeah. And we also love the liver. So why
do?
Yeah. I do love the liver.
How could the liver lead to this, do you think?
I don't know. Like, I'm again thinking about like how I've seen portal hypertension also causing like, it's not necessarily like the like edema necessarily, but I would just think about these like cirrhotic patients I have with like lots of extra water, and then like if they can go like hepatorenal, and then you can gain more, and they have the I don't know, but thing.
I'm going to bite my tongue, and I'm just going to share back what I'm hearing. We seem to be centered on a primary complaint to volume overload, and we're thinking about major buckets that could be contributing to her volume overload, layering on some of the basic information we've got so far. So we're thinking of endocrine causes, we're thinking of hematologic causes in the setting of someone who just was recently pregnant, we're thinking of cardiac causes in the setting of someone young, so a primary cardiac issue would be abnormal, but she was just someone who delivered a baby, and there is known connection there with like dilated or peripartum cardiomyopathy. And then bigger buckets of contributors to volume overload being primary hepatic, primary renal. I think with that, let's move on and get some more information.
All right, so for aliquot, the patient also has
PND, which is paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea.
Okay. Tension, there's no fever, chills, night sweats, there's no skin changes. There is some prior tobacco use. She was had a 15 pack year history and some rare social alcohol use, no recreational drug use, and no pertinent family history. And there's a little bit more information for aliquot too.
From a medication perspective, she's taking methimazole for her Graves' disease. She's taking Lasix, and then she's on a combined oral contraceptive. No supplements or over-the-counter medicines. So I think to recap, from an ROS perspective, she has paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea and orthopnea. She's having dyspnea on exertion. She has the known bilateral lower extremity swelling, and she's also having abdominal distension. She doesn't really have any unique family history to contribute to this. Her exposures are just tobacco use for 15 years, no longer smoking. And then I mentioned the medication she's on.
Sam, do you have any thoughts?
I mean, it's screaming heart to me. Like the paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea screams cardiac to me. The like when she's lying down, she has shortness of breath also is like me thinking of a cardiac cause. Oral contraceptives, I think like where I know I'm like zooming out from cardiac causes, I think how oral contraceptives are further contributing to how I could think that could be like making someone more coagulable, and the distension in her stomach. Do you feel like you've seen, I don't like the big belly, do you feel like you see that in like people with like walking or really fluid overload with heart failure? I think I see like the legs, and you do get like, do get like edema, but like, I don't know maybe if I'm like reading too much into it, but like.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know about the distension. Like, is this ascites distension? Is she constipated? Is she obstructed? Like, you know, cause that'll go in so many different ways, right? Like if she could just, you know, have some sort of constipation or obstruction or ileus for whatever reason leading to this distension. So I want to know, like, is it painful or do we hear bowel sounds? Mm-hmm. I want to know, is it like peritonitic picture?
Yeah.
But like if it was acidic, if we decide like, yeah, there's a fluid wave, like there's a deep enough pocket, like do some sort of centesis and like determine what the, you know, part of the fluid is, and that would probably help direct us. But I think, yeah, like you said, cardiac because of the like orthopnea, having to use pillows. I feel like we're taught in medical school like very much that is cardiac in nature, needing pillows to, you know, elevate yourself to breathe.
And like waking up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Is a cardiac vandal.
I do think it's very insightful. You brought up like still coagulability, 15 pack year smoker, women, estrogen.
Oral contraceptives.
Right. Like post-pregnancy. Like these are all very hypercoagulable. So it'd be like low threshold for like sending tests or scans or worries about some sort of like embolus or severe thing that you'd want to worry about acutely. I still don't think that it is a primary cause though. That's just more of a secondary worry.
And like ads, like I learned about this today that like right around 20 pack years is when they start to screen for like lung cancer. And so I feel like she's also like, you could add all of the things that make her hypervariable. And if she's kind of like kind of leaning towards like malignancy too, like that can also like make you even more so. Like cancer cells can just make things even more.
The only other thing, I want to think about her meds really quick.
The thyroid medication.
And with that one, I know we're taught like the big scary thing is like agranulocytosis, neutropenia kind of situation with that. I don't know if that could contribute here at all. Like, but, you know, we'd have to see with labs.
Cool. I love what I'm hearing so far. I think it's cool to hear you guys bounce back off of each other. It kind of highlights reasoning as a team. And I'm going to share the physical exam now. Her temperature is afebrile. Her heart rate is 91 at the time. Her blood pressure is 122 over 81. She's saturating 98% on Remer. Generally, she's in no acute distress. Her HEENT exam is only pertinent for periorbital edema. She does not have any scleral icterus. Cardiovascular exam was difficult to assess her JVP because of her body habitus. She had distant heart sounds, no murmurs. Pulmonary exam, she had normal worker breathing. She had diminished breath sounds at the bases. There were no crackles or wheezing. Her abdomen was tense, distended. It was non-tender. There was 2 to 3+ pitting edema on the skin on her abdomen. Her extremities were warm. She had 3+ pitting edema all the way up to her abdomen, as I mentioned. Neuro exam was unremarkable. She had no rashes or bruising. So that was a lot. I'll kind of highlight some of the pertinence there. I think vitals, she's hemodynamically stable. She has periorbital edema. She has diffuse edema, as evidenced by periorbital edema, abdominal pitting edema. She had distant heart sounds. She couldn't assess for a JVP. And her pulmonary exam, she had distant lung sounds in the basis.
What are you thinking?
I feel like I feel less I'm walking away from the liver.
Yep. Why is that?
I guess just like not necessarily that you'd be seeing like I don't know how quickly you'd see like hyperbilirubin anemia or how quickly you'd see like scleral icterus. I think that doesn't show like that acutely here.
Sure.
And she's also hemodynamically stable and doesn't like appear to be like super, super sick or super ill. Other than like being short of breath.
Okay.
The edema in the belly, I have had people that have such significant heart failure that you can like be like pressing on their tummy and like be having stuff like that. But the thing that's like odd to me is like, other than the edema and like the weight and like maybe being short of breath, like in the sleeping and like getting up, like she doesn't really seem that like her vital, like she's hemodynamically stable. And like she doesn't get hard to hear the JVD, but like her also lungs don't sound like crap. Like they're far away, but they don't sound horrible. Like when you hear people with really significant heart failure,
sure.
Like it's like really crackly. So that's what I'm having a hard time like marrying the physical exam.
Yeah, I think like, I don't think it's a hepatic thing. I think we'd see a lot of different things on a physical exam. I'm not gonna fully rule it out. I think endocrine wise, like you'd expect to see periorbital edema with Graves. Maybe it's not there, you know, the level of therapy is not enough with the methamazole, however you say that. I also do know that like there are post-pregnancy like thyroid issues. I know she diagnosed with Graves, could be maybe a different version of a thyroid problem. But yeah, the 2 to 3+ pitting edema on both the abdomen and the lower extremity is pretty severe. So I would say like cardiac is still like, this like peripartum, postpartum cardiomyopathy is still very high on my thought process here. Would definitely want to get things like BNP, you know, chest x-ray to see truly the fluid in the lungs. She's not febrile, so I'm not worried about like some sort of infectious cause here.
She's not in like acute heart failure either. Like she doesn't have like, when you said distant heart sounds, I kind of started thinking of like, yeah, or something like, you know, fluid around the heart or something, but that would like look so much worse. And she almost like doesn't, like she, like her lungs don't sound great, but they're not like horrible.
It sounds like you guys are narrowing down your buckets, which is exciting. Then we're going to move on to the next aliquot.
So we have some initial data. I think you guys have gotten all you need from a history perspective. I think we have some focused areas we're interested in investigating, and now it's time to do some testing. Basic labs, her chemistries are all normal. Her creatinine is 0.57. Her white count is 8. Her hemoglobin is 11.6, which is stable compared to serial hemoglobins, and her platelets are 320. Her liver tests, ALT, AST, are 9 and 23 respectively. Her alkfos is normal. Her T-belly is a little elevated at 1.8. Her albumin is 3.3, which is a little low. And INR was 1.1, which is normal. Beta-HCG was negative. BNP was 36, which is normal. Lipids were normal. And TSH was 8.62, which is mildly elevated. And free T4 was 1.08, which I believe is normal. Her UA, she had no blood in her urine. and no protein in her urine.
Wow.
So
what is abnormal? Anything?
I mean,
what were you expecting?
I was expecting BNP to be much higher. You know, it's a really big test with cardiomyopathies and yep. like heart failure type stuff.
Yeah. Yep.
And for if we were still heart failure, if like another way that I like measured heart, like how well we were diuresing people with heart failure was like how their kidneys were also like, I don't expect anything to be like happening with the kidneys too to have to compensate
yeah.
for the
fluid. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the kidneys are up, not impressive. It's not like really like biliary tree-ish.
Right. Liver enzymes were all great.
Yeah.
Chemistry being all great is a little surprising too. Like, you know, that's interesting.
Where do you go from here?
Well, I mean, yeah, from here, I want to do some imaging. I want to see, you know, labs don't always show everything. So I want to definitely see the lungs and the heart.
Okay.
Probably chest x-ray to start. And given she is acytic in the abdomen. Yeah, she is acytic, right?
She's like, she has a beard. We don't necessarily, physical exam, it's not like okay. this IDs. Like,
okay.
It's a quick way to check.
Seeing a fluid wave.
Cool.
Like playing.
They could do an ultrasound.
Could do that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, nothing's that crazy on labs, which then makes me again like feel like it's like something silent and yeah. subtle that over time with all her stuff built up to have this physical presentation.
The only thing on her, the thyroid stuff is kind of interesting. It's kind of like subclinical, but.
And what was her primary problem?
Of the thyroid stuff?
Yeah.
It was Graves.
Right.
Which is interesting because the TSH is high and the T4 ESET is like one.
Yeah.
Which is weird because I feel like high TSH, low T4, that's. Yeah, that'd be more of a hypo.
Yeah, I think she's probably just being overtreated a little, actually.
Right. Okay.
Good.
All right. Got some imaging for you.
Great.
We have a chest x-ray, which is often our first radiologic study, right? What you're seeing here is a normal chest radiograph from a quality perspective. Her lung fields are clear bilaterally. What is pertinent finding here are blunted costophrenic angles bilaterally. So she has pleural effusions on both sides, and then an enlarged cardiac silhouette. But I would say those are pertinent positives, and the pertinent negative here being normal lung fields.
But the imaging is not really adding anything. He didn't.
I mean, yeah, cardiomegaly is still interesting to me. I mean,
yeah.
It's a little bit, and yeah, pleural effusions.
Still matters.
Next, we have an EKG, which reflects normal sinus rhythm with globally reduced voltages.
Okay.
And then we got an ultrasound. This is actually pictures of my bedside cardiac ultrasound I did on her.
Cool.
And just for the audience, in a peripheral long view, her EF was preserved based on an anterior motion of the, or a systolic motion of the anterior leaflet, concentric squeeze, and cavity change. And then on the subxiphoid view, we see a circumferential pericardial effusion with no echocardiographic evidence of tamponade. And in the apical foreview, we're also seeing that. And it's a very pretty picture, and the heart is swinging within this pericardial effusion. Mm. But there's no echocardiac evidence of tamponade. Let's pause there.
Yeah. Can you go back to the EKG real quick?
Yeah.
This is like, it's like something on the tip of my brain. Low voltage QRS is definitely like super important here. And I'm like trying to remember, I mean, pericardial effusion.
When it's in there, that's when it gets low. And the whole, like, when it's swinging around,
right.
That's like the electrical alternans or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
When it's sitting in, like, the thing of fluid, it's just, yes. like,
yep.
not.
So what is that?
I mean, like, well, it's not tamponading yet, but it's a pericardial effusion.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's hard for the electric voltage to be read by the leads when there's a pocket of fluid kind of interrupting that transmission. So my differential on low voltage EKGs are really two things to, like, in the moment, it's an infiltrative cardiomyopathy or pericardial effusion. Mm-hmm. So what do we think about that? Normal, abnormal? Why does a 38-year-old woman have a pericardial effusion?
Yeah, I mean, it's not ideal. I think the postpartum state definitely is playing some sort of role here.
Okay.
Why does fluid get in the sac around on the heart?
Mm. Mm.
Is it, like, the tissue itself? Is it her fluid state? Is it an infectious cause? Is it a connective tissue thing? Is it?
These are great questions.
All good questions. We have some more. We're going to look through a CT abdomen and pelvis, which is, we're rolling through it, but it's highlighting diffuse body wall edema from head to toe. And then we're getting a look at organs, which reflect an asymmetrically enlarged left adnexa to 6 centimeters. Which may represent an ovarian lesion, extensive findings of fluid overload, moderate ascites, moderate pleural effusions, diffuse subcutaneous edema. we're like, oh man, adnexal mass, this is abnormal. So we also get a pelvic ultrasound to further characterize the adnexal mass. And the left ovary is measuring 5.5 by 4 by 4.5 centimeters. The Doppler on that is normal. There's fluid in the cul-de-sac.
Okay. This is great. I'm having like, I don't know if this is it, but there's like, when you have an ovarian mass like this, well, there's this thing called Meig syndrome, which is like ovarian, I believe fibroma. You have like pleural effusions in your lung and something else, right? Have you heard of this?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Otherwise, ovarian epithelial cancer can also lead to a lot of the fluid overload that we're seeing here. So, what do you think it's like?
I think it's like she has cancer of her ovaries and the cancer cells themselves are cells of an identity that are secreting like hormones or secreting substances that are causing like the fluid overload that are causing her pathology. And yeah, I think it could be like, not necessarily like this is the only thing, but I feel like there's something like cancerous happening there.
Yeah. This is
because there are the cells. Remember, there's a specific type of ovarian. There's a specific type of cancer of the ovaries that secretes thyroid stuff.
Oh, like you were thinking like the teratoma thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I forget what it's called, but it's like
mixomat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's what I think.
Sounds like some of our attention has shifted to her pelvic organs.
It has. We ignored them earlier. We did.
Maybe rightfully so. Why? What reason did you have to think about it, right? And I'm only saying this because, hey, I was the one who did this in real time, and I definitely was not thinking about them.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, she's a young, otherwise pretty healthy lady. Cancer is not at the top of anyone's mind, initially at least. Sounds like it's on your guys' mind now and other non-cancerous causes. You mentioned Meig syndrome. That's astute. Where would you go from here?
Well, we'd want to do a workup. I'm sure you'd probably get OB-GYN involved. Maybe gynonc. You need to do. I mean, we have the pelvic ultrasound.
We probably the pelvic ultrasound. You could get a biopsy of the.
Could do a biopsy. Yeah, you could do also get some
like markers.
Yeah. You could get markers. I want to say I know CA125 is prominent in these cancers. However, you might not be the best thing in someone premenopausal because it can be. Can conflict with other things in their hormones that would lead to a false elevation.
Sure.
So, I would say get the experts in, get OB-GYN, get gynonc. They're probably going to want maybe like...
I want a path sample.
Okay.
The thing.
Yeah, we want a sample, maybe like a laparoscopy or something.
Okay. So some advanced second pass studies, reaching out to help from experts.
Yes.
And then maybe honing in on getting some tissue. I like it. Carolyn, you want to walk us through some advanced studies that were done?
Yeah, so... We do some second pass studies. We find that the ANA is greater than 1 over 1,280. Normal complement, there's no dry eye, no mucosal dryness, no oral ulcers, no pulmonary disease, no cavities, no neuropathy or synovitis, and the hemolysis labs are negative. You want to continue and give a little more info?
Yeah, I do want to explain. So we kind of ordered the autoimmune workup kind of centered around the pericardial effusion, kind of thinking about a connective tissue process. Yeah. But her review of systems is completely negative for that. She did reflex test positive for SSA. So we kind of went back and asked targeted Sjogren's questions and weren't getting anything there. So as you guys will know, that ANAs can be abnormal in folks without autoimmune disease. And I don't know if that was the case here, but hers was markedly elevated without any other explanation, though, so kind of an isolated elevated ANA. We then did get some tumor markers. So a CEA and AFP were both normal. A CA125 that Andrew brought up was 250, which is markedly elevated.
Yeah, we need to explore that further then. I need to fact check what I said earlier about the CA125 not being the best in premenopause. I am not entirely sure if that is accurate or not, but the fact that it's super markedly elevated is concerning.
I think what you appropriately brought up, you're questioning the specificity of it.
Yeah.
And it is not an entirely specific test. Okay. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
But I feel like it's either that, or isn't there another one like very similar to 125 or 19, like with pancreatic cancer also?
19.9.
Yeah. 19.9. Yeah, so, it calls for further workup. I appreciate the autoimmune workup because then when you guys were mentioning labs, I was like, oh, I didn't even think about like a lupus cause or something like that. But probably want sampling now.
Want to biopsy it.
Okay. We want to go for tissue. Mm-hmm. We do have some fluid pockets that we could look into. Mm. So I think I'll lead into the next aliquot with that, and that kind of her most pressing medical problem is her pericardial effusion. She's young and is compensating well, but if anything were to change, that would probably be the most of significance.
Sure.
So we work with our interventional cardiologists and get a pericardiocentesis to actually leave a drain in. She's off my service for 2 days while she has the drain in, and we get fluid studies off that. The fluid was yellow/clear appearing. There was 43 nucleated cells, some RBCs. It was lymphocytic predominant. The glucose was 100, which is normal. The protein was 4.3, which is normal. The LDH was 120, which is normal. There was infectious studies sent, cultures that were sent, all normal, no organisms ever grew. And the cytology on the fluid was negative for malignancy, which I'll summarize for you, not make you think too hard, but transudative fluid, no infection, no evidence of malignancy.
In the pericardial fluid.
Just the pericardial fluid, yeah.
But I still feel like it could still be the cancer from somewhere else that is like causing there to be, I still feel like it could be the cancer from somewhere else that's causing the transudative fluid. Like, just because there's not like something going on in the fluid around the heart itself directly doesn't mean that I'm not convinced still.
Sure. Okay. I think I'm going to bring us back for a second and use this opportunity to just kind of recap, because I needed this refresher and spent a lot of time reviewing this because it had been quite some time, about adnexal masses. Andrew started to highlight some, but I think thinking of it in three big categories, the two biggest being benign versus malignant, and then kind of other. In the benign, you can have functional cysts, you can have endometriomas, you can have PCOS, hemorrhagic cysts, and then the bigger category being benign ovarian masses, which include serous cystadenomas, mucinous cystadenomas, Brenner's tumors, teratomas, fibromas, decomas. The malignant bucket includes epithelial ovarian, germ cell, sex cord stromal cell, and other metastatic cancers. The other is really tubo ovarian abscess. We looked at Dopplers on her. She's had normal Dopplers, peritoneal cancer, lymphoma, primary lymphoma of the ovaries, or metastatic, and then ovarian remnant syndrome too. So the differential's huge, actually. The biggest kind of focus is first on benign versus malignant, characterizing then what benign etiologies, whether it's cystic or otherwise, and then honing in if it is malignant on the type is important. I say this because I think it's all leading towards the question we all had is, what is this adnexal mass, right? That's got to be the answer. Mm-hmm. So we talk to our gyno colleagues. The pericardiocentesis was really done as pre-op planning. They wanted her to be optimized for surgery. So she's with us for about a week. We address the pericardial effusion. We decongest her, help her symptomatically feel better from the just diffuse volume overload. I think we call it anasarca at this point. She goes to the OR with gynoc. We're rounding. I get a call from the fellow with verbal findings and then some frozen path results. So the left fallopian tube and ovary showed serous cystadenoma up to 4 centimeters in the greatest dimension. The fallopian tube was benign. The right ovarian, there was also a right ovarian cyst that they resected that was also serous cystadenoma. So let's go back for a second on kind of what I walked through. But serous cystadenoma is a functional cyst of the benign category. I'll pause there before I share more.
How could something that's benign, even if it's big, I don't know the scale, how something that's benign cause like that much fluid overload?
I'm thinking OB-GYN is my first rotation. So what was that, like 6-7 months ago? I don't have that much of an excuse. I still know this stuff. But I do know, I'm thinking back now to the abdomen. I do know that like a lot of ovarian masses can lead to buildup of edema, expansion of masses into the abdomen as well. It doesn't sound like they found that, but I'm just trying to connect some dots now. Serous cystadenoma. Yeah, I don't know. The CA-125 is still shocking.
Yeah. I'm going to share some more of the phone call.
Okay, let's hear the
fellow said, this is not Mike's syndrome. This is not Mike's syndrome.
Interesting.
We don't see this kind of benign mass causing Mike's syndrome. He shared more, which I'm withholding for a second while you guys kind of share your thoughts. We'll get there.
He went out of his way to say it's not Mike's syndrome. Yeah.
Confidently, he's like, this is not Mike's. We thought this was Mike's from the moment we found that ovarian mass. Mm. Like, this is Mike's syndrome, this is Mike's syndrome. We actually hoped it would be Mike's syndrome because it's benign often, right, and everything gets better with resection of the mass. So I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
What is it then?
I'd be curious to hear if they found any like omental caking or anything.
Just funny you share that, because they found some very abnormal things in her abdomen. Mm. It was laparoscopic. He said, the liver looks weird, not normal.
Liver.
We actually drained 6 liters of green acidic fluid
Wow.
And for our listeners, I'm actually sharing intra-op pictures that were taken, and it's showing a nodular, diffusely nodular liver and then green fluid surrounding it.
Mm-hmm. Crazy her liver enzymes were showing that.
Yeah, kind of wonder. They fortunately, my next question was, please tell me you took a sample of the liver.
Yeah.
They did. The parenchyma had cirrhosis, stage 4, severe macrovascular steatosis. There's ballooning degeneration. There's patchy areas of lobular inflammation. They did a bunch of stainings that basically look for potential etiologies of her cirrhosis, including like alpha-1 antitrypsin, hemochromatosis, Wilson's disease, et cetera, and all the stainings were negative. So I think the pertinent findings here, we have a serous cystadenoma, which is a benign ovarian mass, not known to cause Meigs syndrome. We had a grossly abnormal appearing liver that was cirrhotic on biopsy with a severe amount of steatosis and then some other pathologic findings.
Where does this leave us?
Well, the liver gets the mice, you know, back into a playing field.
Pregnancy can cause fatty liver. Yeah. I don't think it can. I couldn't think of it causing like cirrhosis though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking, I don't know if this is like helpful for this case specifically, but a mnemonic for like causes of cirrhosis. I know Kevin like went through a lot of them, but like VW happens is the name of this mnemonic. It's like viral hepatitis, Wilson's disease, hemochromatosis, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, primary biliary cholangitis, primarily sclerosing cholangitis, ethanol, which is alcohol, and then like a non-alcoholic cause. So those are like a lot of the big buckets of cirrhosis causing.
Yes. I love that you bring that up. I think it's a good segue, and then we can kind of recap, but we do a bunch of liver tests. Her hepatitis, other viruses, alpha-1 antitrypsin, celiac, hemochromatosis, Wilson's were all negative. Her quant IgGs were normal. Her anti-smooth muscle was abnormal, 1 to 160. And then we checked a PETH, which is basically an A1C for alcohol use, and that was negative. I'll pause there. So we do a first pass evaluation of causes of cirrhosis that were unrevealing, other than maybe an elevated anti-smooth muscle antibody. But thinking about that more and layering on the pathologic findings that didn't end up making sense pathologically, you typically see different findings more of like a lymphocytic infiltration, et cetera, plasma cell infiltration with that. I think one of the path findings was actually really helpful in explaining her cirrhosis since the degree of steatosis, which was about 70%. So I'll pause there before I think I ask you guys to tell me what you think the final diagnosis is.
Sam, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I feel like even that you listed out all the causes of the liver, of like, you know, liver failure. Sure. But in my experience, I feel like that last bucket of like non-alcoholic or cryptogenic cirrhosis is this like gigantic umbrella of things that like go under there. And that's how I'm kind of like, I don't know. I feel like it's like cryptogenic cirrhosis, but like.
Yeah, second, but, like some cause of like the steatosis.
Yeah.
Like not alcohol induced.
Maybe it could be a little autoimmunity because of like the antibody that you guys found, not that it's. Maybe.
Did we ever have a, we didn't talk about a lipid panel on her, did we?
We did earlier, and it was, she had hyperlipidemia.
Right.
Her triglycerides were elevated, and I believe her LDL was in the 70s.
Okay.
So not classic, super hyperlipidemic. So I'm going to recap. This case is a young woman who presented with chronic volume overload and all the effects of that. She was found to have a pericardial effusion, pleural effusions, ascites, and a sarca. Imaging found an ovarian mass. We all thought this was a primary ovarian mass causing all these secondary effects, which was then changed intraoperatively with path that didn't fit that picture, and then the gross appearance of a very abnormal liver, despite many tests not giving any signal towards that being the case. What's your guys' final diagnosis?
I just want to follow cryptogenic cirrhosis.
Yeah, I mean, stay
like I don't know cirrhosis.
Like hepatic steatosis.
Causing liver. After pregnancy.
I think it's semantic at this point, but the final diagnosis is cirrhosis secondary to metabolic associated liver disease causing volume overload, diffuse volume overload.
Wow.
We end up testing her for basically a genetic variant. She's 38. Why does she have metabolic associated liver disease? Actually, why does she have cirrhosis from metabolic associated liver disease? And she was homozygous for this variant known to increase your risk for steatosis, inflammation, fibrosis, the PNPLA3.
Right.
At the time that I finished taking care of her, she left the hospital. We were still wondering whether autoimmune hepatitis was a possible explanation for this, but she has since followed up with hepatology, and they do not think that's the explanation. They think it is metabolic-associated liver disease, the etiology of her cirrhosis. Crazy.
Wow. Yeah. What an interesting case.
Took so many turns. It was a diagnostic journey. We were like, oh my God, this is Meig syndrome. Like, we're never going to see that again. This is it. This is the one, right? Nah. Cirrhosis.
Yeah, it's always the liver.
This case was so fun because there were like 5 points during this conversation where I was like, oh my God, it's this. Or oh my God, and like, it wasn't that, you know?
I don't think we anchored that much on anything.
I remember one point Andrew said, it's not hepatic. But I'm not going to rule it out yet.
Yeah.
I'm smacking my face for that, but that's fun.
Yeah, this was a fun one. And I still check in kind of a couple times here and there. And she's doing well. I think eventually she'll need to be worked out for liver transplant.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what does the rest of her life look like?
As far as I could put together through the notes, is she's doing well, has not had any, other than the ascites, further decompensation of her cirrhosis. And it's just on a watching pathway, kind of addressing metabolic factors and then treating symptomatically with decongestion, et cetera. But as far as I know, she has not undergone a transplant evaluation yet, I anticipate eventually will, but so far doing okay.
Didn't the pregnancy cause any kind of flare or cause any start to this?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I know because stuff like this takes a long time to happen. I don't think it helped in the sense that it might have tipped her over from the volume overload perspective. That kind of seems to be the starting point for when all these symptoms started happening. So I think that stress on her body became too much. And then once you start getting pericardial effusion, right, that's that kind of the end pathway of volume overload in this case. So I think it was a cumulative buildup of volume overload from her liver disease that pregnancy didn't help out with, and it was noise the entire time. The cysts, which are common, right, ovarian cysts are common. It just made us, everything else was so abnormal. We're like, it's got to be this. Nope, it wasn't.
Cool.
That was fun, guys. It was really cool to listen to you. Thanks for reasoning through that case. Hope you had fun doing it.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
All right, guys. See you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks again for listening. Person, time, and place. See you next time.